has been baptized by John the Baptist, And in the Bible, explicitly in Luke, it talks about a Pharisee inviting Jesus into his home. And one of the phrases that stood out to me, at least, was that when in their thoughts is saying, well, he's been baptized by John the Baptist and we haven't. So there's a split. And something that they've been saying is not messing up with what he's doing. And I think that creates a rub. But this water theme, from the beginning to the end, there's so much representation. Christ taking out boats, Christ calming the seas. Christ, I mean, you get all of these water representations. And water back then is a scary thought. The seas, when it is rough, is a scary thought. They don't have the luxury of some of the boats and technology that we have today. And so back then, waters is a huge theme. When Moses is taking them across, their thought is, well, it's death one way or the other. You have the Egyptian army closing in, that's death. You have the water, that's death. So they're trapped, right? And once again, God is calling them into the water. And the representation that they're going to make in your book, which I appreciate, is a lot of stuff happens in the water, biblically. And we're going to, again, we're going to harp a little bit on baptism today. That's going to be a quick snippet, but it'd be naive to avoid the presentation here. It'd be naive to, I mean, people like to, and I'm not one of the guys who's just going to hit you over with the Bible and say you need to be baptized. What Kevin said my whole growing up years, what he continues to say in his lessons, I believe is wholeheartedly accurate. There's a lot of wet people who aren't saved. And so I don't think that's the sole purpose. Again, baptism is something that you're committing your life to Christ. And I think the beauty of some of these representations is that it's not just getting wet. God's calling these people into imminent death is how they're perceiving it. They're giving their lives. They're in their presentation, in their minds, they're walking through one of the scariest things known. I mean, there's all kinds of fears out there, right? But I imagine in these days, a lot of parents' fears or kids going by the water. There's just a lot of fear behind this, and God's calling them into that. There's transformation that's had in the water. In this case, that torch passes. Moses brought them in the waters. It's two bookends. When they're fleeing into the wilderness, Moses brings them in. Brings them in through what? The Red Sea. Moses crosses the Red Sea with his people. When they're going into the Promised Land, guess what God calls them back into? The Jordan River. And so there's two bookends of water, and we have to see the purpose in it. And how it plays out throughout the Bible is incredibly important. So we'll get into that here shortly. We're going to go ahead. I guess this would be called preamble or something, but it took way too long. We're going to go ahead and go to Joshua 3. And I'm going to read 1 through 17. That's going to be actually all of Joshua 3. It's short, and then we're just going to read snippets of Joshua 4. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim. And they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, your God, being carried by the Levitical priest, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there shall be distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. 2,000 cubits, a long distance, right? So who's God calling? Who should be probably the most nervous? The people carry in the ark. Because the people have this opportunity to watch them get about halfway through the Jordan before they even go in. For you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua said to the priests, take up the ark of the covenant and pass on before the people. So they took up the ark of the covenant and went before the people. The Lord said to Joshua, today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priests who bear the ark of the covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now therefore, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man, and when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters of the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priests bearing the ark of the covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priests bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water, now the Jordan overflows all its banks. Throughout the time of the harvest, the waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far away at Adam, the city that is beside the Zarethan, and to those flowing down towards the sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off, and the people passed over opposite Jericho. Now the priests bearing the ark of the covenant of the Lord stood firmly on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel was passing over on dry ground until all the nation finished passing over the Jordan. So there, it's almost identical, and that's what y'all probably get tired of me talking, but there is so much repetition in the Bible, and it's important to see all these stories. The other point that I was going to make that before we go any further, I want to remind y'all of is just the whole context of this story, of a lot of biblical stories, almost every biblical story. A lot of people get it right. But I want to take it, surprise, surprise, all the way back to Genesis and the fall of man. Because that wording gets repeated so frequently in the Bible. In almost every main character story, the fruit was pleasing to the eye. So man takes it, right? A lot of other stories, we talk about Abram at the time and his wife, and they saw his wife as pleasing to the eye, and Abram gives his wife up. And we see this repetitiveness. Now, the stories may be tweaked a little bit, but in most of these instances, you're going to have something that's pleasing to the eye. And these people, from the first time that they spot the land, know that the land is good, pleasing to the eye. Fruit, the first set of spies bring back these branches with what are they called? What's the thing that brings?
Clusters.
With huge clusters, thank you. With huge clusters of fruit. And the people start to get excited. And then what's the report they give? Hey, the land's good, but we got no chance against these people. And then their immediate reaction was to do what God had initially said, even after the promise was already pulled for that group of people. And what do? They try to rush in and take it again. And it's unsuccessful. But these people know that the promised land is good. And this is where I want y'all to see there's different iterations coming from. Sometimes God's given you the good. But oftentimes, as a human tendency, what's our immediate thought a lot of times when you have a few really good months? We're waiting for the bad. Right? Oftentimes we get in these positions where I'm like, oh, wow. These last 4 months have been incredible. I wonder what's going to happen. And we get in that mindset, and you can see it evidently in these people where there's oftentimes the biblical story, and to come, I imagine we get into David, Bathsheba. He sees and sees that she is in, he sees something that he wants to take that he's not supposed to. The fall of man sees something that he wants to take he's not supposed to. I don't know why I'm spacing on this name, but there's a guy who stole gold from a plunder that was supposed to be given to God. With probably already acres. Oh, man. We talked about it not too long ago, and I'm spacing on it. He sees that this gold is good. He wants to keep it for himself. And God comes out and plagues the Israelite people. Because he's taken this thing that's supposed to be for God because it's pleasing to his eye. He wants to keep it, and so he does. And so over this whole time, we keep saying, it's pleasing to the eye, it's not good. It's pleasing to the eye, it's not good. It's pleasing to the eye, it's not good. And then all of a sudden, God's trying to give these people the promise. His promise. And so what should that inflict in our minds?
What's wrong with it?
Well, yeah, but also, God's not just withholding for the purpose of withholding. God is saying there will be good, there will be good things, there is a great promise. But whose way is it going to have to be? God's way. See, this whole time, when even in Genesis, we have a lot of stories of people trying to get back to a place of being with God. The whole point of the Tower of Babel, what did they say? They're going to build a tower up to the heavens, right? To somehow just purge this gap between man and God, because it was the distance gap, apparently. And it made sense in their heads, right? But we have story after story of God making a promise, people acting on it themselves in their own way, and what happens? It all goes wrong, right? But through this whole story, what is God's blessings are, and I'm not sure how many times blessing is repeated in the Bible, but it's quite a bit. God's not a withholding God. Because it's easy to see him that way, right? How many times, there's a whole story, they were wandering the desert for however many more years than they should have, because what did they try to do? Go about it their own way. These human tendencies are often the cause, always the cause, of separation. Story after story, the separation is not caused by God, because what does God want?
Relationship
with us. Closeness with us.
Achan is the name of
Achan. Acres, I don't know why.
Achan was close.
Sounds like a horse. Right? thank you. So, story after story, is God's not withholding. Humans aren't listening. This is the most frustrating thing with my son, so I can only imagine how God feels. Right? Because he's got a lot more kids than I do. Is you tell him something, you see him register it, and then he does something else. Why? I know, that's what I'm scared of, right? The little one's not even on her yet.
Yes.
And Brooks does have a big vocabulary for his age, but I'm scared of when he gets more words. But you can only imagine, you watch your own kids doing it, you watch people that you care about do it. You can only imagine what God's feeling. His desire is for relationship, and through that relationship, closeness, right? And yes, God is here, but we're talking about separation. I'm talking about the lack of separation, the tearing of the veil. I'm talking about being with Him. His desire is that. I think everybody in the room wants that. Right? Out of our human tendency, though, what often happens? We try to do it our way. The way we perceive is control. The way we perceive is, hey, maybe I can get this done a little bit faster. I'm impatient. My son's very impatient. I thought I was impatient. Dad probably says the same thing about me when I was little. I've got more patient.
When you were little?
I said more patient. I didn't leave this whole thing with I'm impatient, right? But guys, just story after story. And this is one of the good stories, right? Here we're coming into a group of people behind a leader. And they're supporting them in Joshua, which Joshua is just the face and the mouthpiece of God, just like Moses was. But you finally have some buy-in, you finally have them going in the right direction, and you're finally getting to the culmination of a promise. But don't forget about everything that led up to this, because this is a good story. And it's not over. Next week's going to be about Jericho. But this is the beginning of something good and the fulfillment of a promise, which should be super exciting for all these people. But on the backside, you have to realize how many times they missed it. Right? How many times that they've been in the spot that they could have taken hold of something good. Not something pleasing to the eye, but genuinely good because it's promised by God. See, oftentimes in our heads, I imagine most of the fruit in the garden was good. Right? This is the perfection. This is the original creation. I imagine all these other fruits were probably pleasing to the eye. For about the forbidden fruit that people want to grab a hold of, right? It's just something about this fruit that you've been told no to that people want. It's nothing different from nowadays. God's not promising something poor. It's grand, but beyond our wildest imagination. That's God's promise. It's us settling. It's, hey, God's given you every tree in this garden with stuff that I guarantee is good to the eye. It didn't say that these things were just, what's the weirdest looking fruit? I have no idea. But it's not like God saying, hey, you're just going to get this disgusting fruit and there's something really delicious on the other side of the garden and don't touch that. God's saying, I've given you the promised land. A land flowing of milk and honey with clusters, thank you, Melanie, of fruit so big that you have to carry them out on a branch. God's promise is good. And then we settle. We settle for what? Well, nowadays I can think of a few things. We settle for immediate gratification. That's the society we live in. oftentimes that's the cause of a lot. I mean, you can almost stem that into everything. Is, hey, God, well, if I live to 75, 80, I mean, whew, for me, that's a long ways away, right? I'm like, oh, my, it's got to be something right now. So what do I take? I take what's now, what's here, what's in front of me. And you see God's people take what's now, what's here, what's in front of me. And they're putting in jeopardy the promise of something way bigger, way greater. I'm pretty convinced. The Bible doesn't say so. This, so I'm going to go out and say this is Hunter's opinion, so chalk it up as that. But I am convinced the garden was magnificent with fruits that we wish we could have now instead of the stuff that we get in the grocery stores that turn moldy in 3 days, right? I'm convinced that there was beauty and goodness in what God gave man. And what we did is settle for something less. Something that was pleasing to the eye. How often does the pleasing to the eye just please your eye because it's forbidden? Maybe in a way better circumstance than where you're at. And you go out and settle for something. Why? Because it looks way better than it actually is. So keep that in mind. Because story after story, pleasing to the eye. And these people are about to capture God's promise. Which there are some stories in the Bible that are that. There's a lot of shortcomings in some stories in the Bible that are that. So keep that in mind. It's not God's promise is, whoa, I can't put words to it, you can't put words to it. God is not withholding. God desires for His kids. How many of you guys desire something better for your kids than what you have? I think that's a God-given thing. I think that is a desire provided by God, is to take care of and to help flourish. The blessings are be fruitful and multiply, right? God blesses over and over again. He does it throughout several generations. God wants that. God wants y'all to take hold of the promise. God wants us to be in the promised land. God wants us to have a relationship with Him. It's us.
I had a conversation with a person that I worked with this week, and she was just distraught because she had raised her son in the church, and she thought, you know, they thought they had done everything right, and he's doing way things that he shouldn't be doing, and she's heartbroken over it. And she's like, but we did everything, it was right there. He was raised, he knows. But he's choosing this. And she goes, I don't understand. She was angry and she was frustrated. And I'm thinking, we do the exact same thing. Because God gives us everything we need to know. He shows us the way. And what do? We mess it up. Or we choose something we shouldn't. And so it was like, when she was saying that, and what you said this morning, is parallel. It's exactly. But she, and it's like I told her, I said, you can't force him to make good decisions. He has a free will to do that. Just like God gives us that free will to make those bad decisions, that because we think we know what's best. At the moment, He thinks He knows what He wants and what's best. And so it's that parallel thing. It's like you see it all the time. The rebellious teenager or the rebellious old adult like me.
And the hard thing is genuinely is the self-reflection aspect. Because, and that's what I hope that over the time that I've been talking, that I hope y'all have put yourselves in some of those positions. I hope y'all have, because we, whether we realize it or not, we do it. All these things that we talk about, we do it. And so, Brooks is going to do something really dumb one day. It shouldn't surprise me. Yeah, Brian, no. Something. Aw, oh, you're kidding me. It's going to happen. Kids are kids, humans are humans. I've done a lot of really dumb stuff that my father can testify to. Not good stuff, bad stuff, terrible stuff, stuff that I just know breaking God's heart, breaking my dad's heart, breaking my mom's heart. And I know that. And it's not like I was naive to that fact when I did. So it often just takes a level of honesty, because guess what? When we talk to people, what do they want? Honesty. You know how many conversations I've got to have with people over the short three, I guess if you take them all and go back to Smith, several years, but in 3 years of Autoworld, how many conversations I've had with people that have just said sorry and been honest. You're dealing with 800 people a month at the very minimum, stuff gets dropped through the crack. And what does nobody want? This is what I tell my service, our guest Kevin, service manager. Sorry, Kevin. I took some ownership there. Guess what I've told Kevin, service manager? Never lie. You drop the ball, call somebody and say, hey, I dropped the ball. I'm ordering your part right now. I apologize. And I brought him in because he dropped the ball on one customer and I wanted to prove a point. So I brought him into my office and I made the phone call and I told this lady, ma'am, we dropped the ball. I am super sorry. I'm getting it ordered right now, and as soon as we get the part, I'm going to have our mechanics make it first priority. I'm so sorry. There's no excuse for that. It's our fault. Guess what? She was just in shock. Well, I feel like I should be mad right now, but I appreciate you being honest with me. And I'm like, you have every right to be angry. I understand. I'm sorry to inconvenience you, and we're going to get it fixed. And she goes, well, thank you. Let me know when it's done. She was, I guarantee it, took that phone call expecting an excuse. Guarantee it. Because that's what 99% of people do, right? Oftentimes people just want a little bit of honesty. There's not a person sitting in this room that hasn't struggled with something. And I heard a quote. It wasn't a godly person quoting it or a godly quote at the time, but I'm going to take it and I'm going to turn it into a godly quote, because I think it's actually I think it is a godly quote, said out of the scope of God, which is sometimes I think people get passed down their trauma or put through these terrible experiences so that they can help the next generation. Don't hold that stuff in. You see somebody struggling with something that you've been through. Help. Right? And you have to be incredibly brutally honest in a way that probably makes people think differently about you. And I think that's what's scary. Because oftentimes we do the wrong thing and putting ourselves up, not, and I'm not saying that we do it intentionally, but I'm saying this happens. When we act like we got it all figured out, there's a pedestal you're putting yourself on. And people look up to that. People see that and they may desire that, and they're desiring the wrong thing. You should be pointing that to God, to Christ, giving the glory to Him. Because I guarantee you one thing, and if there's anything that's convinced me of it, it's the internet and politics. Your dirt's going to come up. There's not a person that you can put up for presidency for anything that there's not going to be something that's going to make you think twice about. But that's all. We've all got skeletons in our closet. Instead of making the guy you know that's hurting with something feel like he's all alone, maybe it's time to reveal your skeletons. And let me tell you, that is a form of confession that is godly. I had a lot of skeletons in my closet. The most freeing feeling I've ever had in my life was when I told my wife all of them when we were dating. That felt good. She probably thought a lot less of me after she heard all of it, right? So was married to me. That's her fault. She had the decision. But there's no secrets. She knows my struggles. She knows my hurts. It is open. There's power in that. It doesn't have to be a spouse. It can be your buddy that you sit next to at school. It can be whatever the case. People sitting in these pews. People sitting across the office from you. But there's always the opportunity. And you just got to be comfortable owning that you're a sinner and falling short of the glory of God. If you get comfortable with that, I can tell you for a fact, life gets a lot easier. Stop running from what you've done in the past, and you own it, and you move on with it. It's the only way to move on. It's not a fun feeling when you're just scared of everything and you're trying to hide a lot of secrets. God's saying, hey, own it. Admit that you're a sinner. Admit that you've fallen short, because everybody has. And help people out. Walk with people. This is in the Bible. We know about a lot of people's shortcomings, right? I can only imagine some of these guys sitting there and they're like, oh, they're going to hear about that for a long time. This kind of stinks. Right? And they can't get away from it. It's written in the Bible. There's future generations of grandkids and great-grands and so on are going to know what they did. It's good. The Bible's there to guide. We're there to guide. Own up to it. Move on with life. It's in the past. It's a hard living running away from your past. Alright, I didn't get to a lot of what I wanted to get to, but thank y'all for sitting through my soapbox. Thank you, Linda, for your comments. I hope y'all have a great week, and we'll be back with Jericho next week.